G'day, and welcome to the 2019 Fremantle Press podcast series. My name is Holden Shepherd, and I'm the current winner of the City of Fremantle TAG Hungerford Award. My first novel, Invisible Boys, will be out later this year, but for the next few months, I'll also be your host. Today I am super excited to be chatting with Dave Warner about his new crime novel, River of Salt. Dave Warner is an author, musician and screenwriter. His first novel, City of Light, won the Western Australian Premier's Book Award for Fiction, and Before It Breaks, won the Ned Kelly Award for Best Australian Crime Fiction. Dave originally came to national prominence with his gold album Mugs Game and his band Dave Warner's from the Suburbs. In 2017, he released his 10th album, When. He has been named a West Australian State Living Treasure and has been inducted into the Whammy Rock and Roll of Renown. Dave, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Holden.
Let's dive right into talking about River of Salt, which is an absolutely fantastic and really uniquely Australian crime novel. What makes it particularly interesting to me, this novel, is this juxtaposition between this innocent kind of quaint coastal town and the darker underbelly that you explore in the same town. I mean, it's the same people, but there's kind of two levels of the town going on. So I just wondered what inspired you to construct this story around such a dichotomy.
I had this idea or fascination of using a young guy who was a hitman from a city like Philadelphia that was cold and bleak, and that he just wanted to get away, and he's seeking a whole new life. He doesn't want to kill people. So in a sense, you've got the innocent young guy who is already corrupted in himself, and he winds up in Australia. Hears the sound of a surf guitar, and it changes his life, and he wants to go to California, but in the end he ends up in even further away in Australia. Mm. It seems like a new Eden to him because it looks like he can cast off his past. But, the reality is that people may be different by degrees, but in our natures, there's dark and light and shade and light in all of us. And Blake finds that even on the other side of the world in Australia, in this very pristine kind of Eden that he's discovered, that, human nature can't be segregated the way that natural beauty might. So even where he is in this new place, there's good and evil. And even in Eden, there's snakes, and it falls to him in this story to root them out.
So I think that side of human nature that you talk about, the dark and the light, it really comes through in the characters, and Blake is a great example of that. One thing I'd like to talk about is the themes in here. You talk a lot about guilt, innocence, and redemption, and they're really core themes throughout the whole novel and through a lot of the characters. Why do these particular ideas interest you?
Well, look, I think they are really big common themes that you'll find in just about any literature or even songs or whatever. And certainly for crime novels, they can drive a whole story. It's a great place to start. And I was fascinated by stories of brothers in organised crime stories. The Godfather, On the Waterfront, and the biggest influence on this novel is a short story called The Brothers Rico by Georges Simenon.
All right.
Which also has kind of mafia brothers working together, and the consequences of what happens when one goes astray and how that affects everybody else. But I think, if a character has to forsake or betray a family member, it sets up a really powerful story engine, and it gives the character a long way to travel. And that's good for, it's good for the writer, but it's also good for the reader. It makes it interesting, and you don't know what side the character's going to fall on. And, in this book, I wanted it to be very, very unsure which way Blake was going to go at any time with his behaviours, because that feels real to me.
Yeah, and he does surprise us as well. So, I mean, talking about the death of Jimmy, for example, the metaphor that's used is this river of salt, and it's used in the context of the tears of Blake's remorse when he's actually ratted his brother out. But it's also used in the context of the ocean where he surfs. Where did you come up with that metaphor, and what did you want to achieve with it?
Well, look, it comes from an early 1960s song, River of Salt. That's in a real kind of great croony 60s style. Mm. Brian Ferry covered it on his first solo album, I think it was. A river of salt flowing from my heart. It just fitted the whole oeuvre of the story that I was creating when I heard that song, and it gave me the title. But even when I was working on it, I came to realise, oh, gee, there's a great kind of metaphor for the Pacific Ocean or the ocean as well. And that was, you know, just one of those happenstances that you get sometimes, Holden, when you're writing, that you're able to do these things and it enhances what your original idea was. And you know, there's the idea of water being cleansing and in religious sense, water used for baptism and the renewal of a person and the removal of previous sins, you know. So it worked on all sorts of levels for me, but it actually came purely from that song and the idea that that song kind of fit with the tone that I wanted.
The song's obviously worked out, you know, serendipitously, but I think you've really extended that metaphor fantastically in this novel. And I think what you said about the baptism kind of factor of the water, when I think about those scenes where Blake is surfing, you do get that sense that he's washing away the old life, the hitman life, and trying to come to peace with what he's done to Jimmy. And he still loves Jimmy, obviously. So I think those are really, really lovely scenes, and it's a really wonderful, powerful metaphor. I found these characters really lifelike and typically Aussie in a lot of ways. The dialogue was wonderful. It evoked this kind of really affectionate and kind of nostalgic look at Australia back in the 60s.
I didn't set out to be deliberately nostalgic, but I guess that happens. I'm a child of the 60s. When this story was set, I would have been 8 or 9, I suppose. Yep. And so those memories when you're that age are very vivid to you, and the characters are very vivid. And I guess it's a natural factor when you go back and start to think about these, about that era and recreating things. And you look affectionately, I do look affectionately on my own family who have died and their friends and all the sort of aunties and uncles that you travelled with, who were all great fun, I have to say, and who, you know, was just a fantastic generation of people. But there were also things that I remembered just stuck in my mind that were fashion things in a way at the time. Like the height of class was to have an aquarium in your lounge room. You know, that was a really big deal. Mm. For men, joining a golf club was a big thing, even if they didn't play golf. It gives it a kind of authenticity because I know that that's how life was at that time.
Yes, and you had the local cop kind of striving and desperately wanting the status that came with that. And I did wonder whether you played golf or whether you were into that or not. But music plays a really significant role in this novel. And your background as a musician obviously explains a part of this. But I'm curious as to why, you know, surf music in particular.
Look, this is it's actually the whole genesis of the novel. As you say, I'm a musician and Martin Silly is a terrific guitarist who's played with me a lot. And I live in Manly at the moment in Sydney. And Martin was doing a gig with the original Atlantics band, who were had a huge worldwide hit with a song called Bombora, very famous song. Mm. And Martin and the original guys, Martin had started playing with them, and they were doing a gig just down the road. So I dropped down to this little venue called the Boat Shed. You go down the steps down below, and it could be the 1960s. It's got the wooden bar and the dark, you know, all those things that you don't see anymore in bars in Australia. Look, it's dark, it's got little booths and heavy wood. And when the band started to play, I just got hit by this feeling, just the sound, because surf music they don't play with any words. And it was just like watching a soundtrack. And my initial idea was, I thought, wow, this is great. I want to do something. I want to do a series or a TV series or a book, but I was probably thinking more a TV series at that stage. Mm. Set around the surf scene. But then as I started to think about it, it was, well, what sort of series? Would it be a funny type of Happy Days thing, or would it be a more serious, you know, darker thing? And because the reality is that it's a lot easier for me to write a book than to get a TV series up, which is really hard, I started to think about, well, if this was a book, how would I do it? I then started to think, okay, if it's a crime story and I've got surf, you know, what's interesting about that? And I thought what was interesting was the kind of contrast between the darkness of a world where people are getting rubbed out and then this innocence that we'd people of my age had seen with Frankie Avalon films and Gidget films, surf films set on the beach. Our collective video memory of films and things is of innocence and fun and those big bikinis and long surfboards and stuff. And I found that really interesting. I thought this is a, you know, it is a great kind of contrast. It wasn't something that I consciously started with. It came out of the first conscious thing of it would just be really good to do this show. And the music, as it was playing, was kind of driving the images through my head, and that was really effective.
Yeah, no, and the songs kind of come through. I mean, there's lyrics and there's songs and there's music throughout this novel, and I think it really is evocative of everything you were just describing about the boat shed and all that. It actually kind of it comes through.
Well, I was going to say there's a part in the book at one point where Blake's rehearsing a song that he's written, and it has got words in it. Mm. And I went away and I wrote the song. So I actually wrote the song that he's singing.
All right.
Playing.
And being a musician, that's kind of a cool perk of having, you know, so many multiple skills. You can actually cross genres and forms. So I wanted to ask a little bit about the dark side of this dichotomy, and particularly about Blake. You're siding with Blake and you care about him, and you are pissed off when, you know, the Aussie version of the mob kind of comes in and ruins his Eden. But then you kind of think, hang on, this is a cold-blooded killer. And there's a really effective baseball glove metaphor used about halfway through the novel, and it alludes to that, you know, his past is inescapable. And yet, as a reader, we come to care about him. Why do you think that is, and why do you want us to care about him?
He's a very complex character, which is interesting. But I think the important element with Blake is that he doesn't attempt to shirk his moral responsibility. There's lots of reasons that he ends up the way that he does. And he could use those as excuses, but he doesn't. He knows that what he's doing is wrong. Mm. He knows he could have done a harder, more boring, brain-numbing job in a factory, threading a bolt, or he could have perhaps looked to go and pick fruit or do something that felt more noble. But he's very good at what he does.
Mm.
But he does have a drive. He's not satisfied. He wants to get out of that. He accepts, I guess at the beginning of the book, he accepts that this is his lot, even if he thinks that what he's doing isn't right. But he does want to escape that, and he does recognise that. And ultimately, he does get to the other side of the world, and he's a very decent person, Blake. He treats those who are weaker than him with respect. He's loyal. He puts his life on the line for those he cares about. He never attempts to cut corners where it would be easy for him. He will take on the harder thing if it will improve somebody else's life. So I think those aspects, as long as Blake isn't coming to kill us, you know, we like him because they're all elements that we admire in people. And I think particularly the fact that he's very loyal and that he's prepared to put his own life on the line. And then later, as it turns out, there is a key moment in the story later on where his whole identity could be blown and he's worried that everything that he's worked for could be destroyed and it could be removed if he just kills somebody. And he decides not to do it. And so we see a change over time. And, you know, I think we respect characters who are prepared to change and make hard decisions.
Yeah, no, it's really nice to see Blake's evolution for sure as the novel goes on, and particularly with characters like Doreen or Andy. You know, he has that whole protective thing going on and it actually does endear you to him. There's a line where he mentions, playing guitar and sex were the only times he felt immune from his past, innocent like when he was a kid. Do you ever wish you could be immune from your past?
Well, yes. I think it would be very tempting if I could transform to a younger 30 or 40 year self. I'd be, you know, that would be great, and I could stop myself from making mistakes that I've done. But artistically, you just have to accept, I think, this is what's led you to this point. It's interesting because it can be a bit of a double-edged sword, having a music background and being known as a musician and a songwriter. You know, there can be an element that people don't take your novel writing as seriously. But then on the other hand, that's compensated by people who remember you and who think, oh, well, I might give that a try, you know, see what Dave's writing. So, but I do wish I had another 30 years up the sleeve.
I think. So I'm pretty sure that'll be a common wish. we could all do that. I just wondered, you know, you're across music, you're across writing for the screen, you're across writing books, you write nonfiction as well. Which medium kind of allows you to feel most fully expressed, or do you like the constant shuffle between different medium?
Yeah, look, I really enjoy shuffling between the mediums. Stops me getting bored and keeps things fresh. They're all different. And in terms of, you know, which of the mediums I like, at the time when you're writing a song, that's pretty good. You're sitting down writing it. Can get a bit frustrating. You know, that doesn't quite work, or looking for something else. But that's good fun. The first draft of a screenplay, or the first or second draft before other people get involved, is really good fun. You know, you've got your story, you're working it through, and so it's very much like a novel. The difference is that after that, once something solidifies, and for example, particularly with movie screenplays, once somebody likes it and someone's prepared to put money into it, then you find that the whole process changes. And particularly in film, you get a whole lot of people, directors, producers, distributors, other people who all want their say in, you know, what's right or wrong about the screenplay or what the screenplay should do. And, you know, it's quite laughable in a way, but you know, the writer, in my experience, tends to be very much sidelined, marginalised. So I love writing screenplays up to the point when they're going to be produced. And with books, however, you're generally working with an editor who's very sympathetic to what you're doing, who's really trying to get into your head and make the actual writing get even better. And so, I find that by that stage of the process that writing books tends to be more satisfying because it is more of what you are. And in a band, it's a different thing again. That can be really satisfying because you get to play things live and you're playing with a band. It's a much more collaborative sense. It just tends to be a bit of a different beast when you're doing it with bands. You know, that is part of the fun thing, that things change, and generally I found they get better when other people are involved and you're all simpatico to what you're trying to do. But it isn't a given in bands that everyone's going to be on the same page. So, you know, that's a bit more problematic. So while I enjoy the variety, I like writing the most.
Yeah, no, I can see that. Even as you were talking specifically about the screenwriting phase, I thought that would be so frustrating to kind of have everyone come in and go, actually, we're going to change this whole project. It's going to be like this now. And you're like, but I wrote it. I think I would get so territorial. So no, it does sound like you've kind of got the best balance between all the different forms. Could you share some insight into your writing process? I'm an emerging author myself. I'd love to hear, you know, what do you know and what can I kind of glean from you, please?
Usually what happens with my novels, and not all of them, but most of them start with just one single kind of tangible mood, buzz, concept. Just it's a feeling, you know, it's almost like a little crawling on the skin. Once I've got the inspiration and that feel, then the first question will be what character is going to drive the story, and if it's a crime novel, is it going to be in espresso? It's the criminal, in a way. In Before It Breaks, it's the policeman. In River of Salt, it's the criminal that's driving it. So who's going to drive this story for us? Whose eyes are we going to see the story through? And so once I've got that, then I start to populate with other characters, and I look for reversals and surprises. So I try and plot out the story. Now I've got my characters, I know the feel that I want to get, and then I just literally with a pencil or a pen, grab an exercise book and start in plot points, writing down 10 or 12 points that I think might be key points in the book. And I then go back and start to actually write the book from there, you know, from point one, and things will change. Characters will change. Who the main characters will be will change sometimes. In River of Salt, the ending I changed three times. And while I'm doing this, and this is really for crime writers rather than for general writers, for literary writers, I'm still trying to crack that egg, but for crime writers, I try and set up a number of possibilities. If it's a whodunit, you want to have virtually every main character needs to have some possibility that they could be the killer. And then you try and work from there, which is the best and most surprising reveal, and what sort of reversals can you get. And so for certainly for crime people, I would say read widely in crime fiction and read other books as well, because they will that will give you a different tone. Sometimes, you know, crime writers can just feel like it's being churned out of the sausage factory. But if you read widely on other books too, that will help give you a different sort of tone. But have a look and see what the author is doing that makes it work. You know, are they great with dialogue? And can you see through the machinations of the plot? How are they making you think that it's going to be this person? Mm. The other thing I'd say, Holden, that especially if you've gone to creative writing classes or you've ever dropped in and listened to the stuff of people talking at these various seminars they have, and I hear all the time, character, character, character. People talk about character. Well, that's, in my opinion, in crime is a bunch of baloney. You have to have strong character, and that's going to drive your story, as I said, that's going to give you surprises. But 50% of your story at least is plot.
Yeah.
You know, I describe it, plot is the uncool fat cousin nobody wants to associate with, but plot is going to be what hooks your reader. And for someone who's perhaps not a great writer but has good ideas, you can get a multi-million-dollar seller if you've got a great hook in your plot. Gone Girl, classic example. You know, so don't dismiss that, and look for what your strengths are. If you're great at dialogue, try and keep that as, even if your stories vary, try and keep that as a central part of your book. If you're great at plot, try and work that through. If you're really good at character, make your character really interesting, and get the plot as good as you can. But you know, you're going to drive it from character stuff. That's probably, you know, the best advice I can give.
No, it's great. I'm sitting here going, okay, I have to do this, I have to do that. I have to especially when you talk about plot, because I think you're right, especially with something like crime, you can't afford to have a thin plot. Like, it has to be really meticulously fleshed out. Otherwise, people are going to go, well, why didn't he just do X, Y, Z? You mentioned you changed the ending a few times for River of Salt. When you were changing that ending, did you play with, like, the whodunit element? Like, did you play
with... Yes, definitely.
Yeah, okay, cool.
I initially had one person that I thought was going to be, you know, the bad person, the murderer, let's say. And then I changed my mind and decided it would be someone else, and then I changed my mind again. So I changed it three times. But the good thing was that because I was kind of conscious all along that, you know, I hadn't quite decided who it would be. And so, and that, this is just experience as you're doing the novel, you can see possibilities for people as you're doing it. So you leave open the possibility that this person could become more involved than what you think. In a way, it can be good too to not have decided early on who it should be, because I find one of the classic things that frustrates me in TV watching, when shows aren't that good, or they're not excellent, or they can be excellent in very many ways, some of these crime TV shows, but then there'll be a character in there and I'll go, what's that character? Why is the brother-in-law there? He doesn't really have to be there. And so as soon as you know that there's a character there that doesn't really have to be there, you're pretty much certain that they're the killer.
Guilty.
So, you know, it's a good thing maybe to not decide too early who your killer's going to be, and keep all those options open.
That's really great. I think you may have just helped me get through the last 20,000 words of my next novel. I've been stuck for ages. And I think I might just shift something, and, you know, that it's okay to actually shift the whodunit part. So thank you. I have one more question for you. During the research for this podcast, I discovered you co-wrote the 2014 miniseries on TV, Never Tear Us Apart, The Untold Story of In Excess. So I just wondered what you think writers could learn from musicians.
Yes, look, as funny as it seems, my answer would be not much. You'll need a hard work ethic to crack whatever you're doing in the creative world, you know, whether it's dance or painting or poetry. But look, a band, as I said before, is a collaborative effort. Even if one person writes all the songs, if the band is playing it together and you live in one another's pockets, you'll get on others' nerves. One of the key differences, though, is that each time that you're playing the same song over and over again, and you're playing to an audience. And they're two really different things, very different things. For example, when a writer is writing, when you or I, Holden, are writing, we're doing 96% of it probably by ourselves sitting somewhere, worried about how our words sound. And I always try and think, try and keep in my head what's the reader going to be thinking at this point. But you're second-guessing it. You don't have any direct connection with the reader. You don't even have a direct connection with the reader after your book's out, probably for 6 months or so. You might start to get some feedback from people who say, I really like the book, or it wasn't as good as your last book, or whatever they might say. Hopefully it's always positive. And very few people take the trouble to write and say that they like it, so it's always great when they do. But with a musician, you can play a new, you can rehearse the new song and go out and play it that night, and you can see, literally see from the audience reaction, yeah, this is going to work, or we need to tighten it up here, or no, this isn't going to work how I thought, I'm going to have to rethink it or not do it at all. So that part of it is really quite different. But the one thing I would say that probably writers can learn is that it's a very frustrating experience to get anywhere. You have to spend a long time generally to play your instrument or learn your instrument, even if you're like a natural vocalist and don't have to do that much to it. Chances are that you'll be in a number of bands doing many, many rehearsals, lugging gear around, working late at night, sleeping on a floor somewhere before you ever get close to even making it. And so I think that idea of perseverance, that bands have absolute belief in themselves and perseverance, I think that's probably the key thing that writers can take from musicians, is that musicians absolutely have to believe that they have something unique to deliver, and they have to believe that no matter all the evidence to the contrary. And so writers, especially young writers, when you're sending things out, if the door keeps getting slammed in your face, you just can't give up. You've just got to keep going. And look, eventually you may give up, but don't give up too soon. Give yourself a good few years, of having that door slammed in your face before you think it's time.
I was probably being really restrained when I asked my first question. I'm actually a huge fanboy of that particular moment. So that particular moment in the miniseries, I genuinely had one of those kind of life epiphany moments, and I watched and went, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to work really hard. I'm going to get rejected all the time, and I don't care. I'm going to go to every event. I'm going to do everything I can. I'm going to get myself published eventually. And when I found out that you had co-written that, I just had this total like fanboy moment. So I just want to say thank you very much for that.
Oh, no, pleasure.
Dave Warner, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, thank you, Holden.
That was author Dave Warner talking about his new novel, River of Salt. Until next time, cheers.